Welcome to The Lobbying Show, the show about the people and government relations, how they got into it, and what their jobs entail, what works and what doesn't. I am the host, Jim O'Brien. So we have another interview from Los Angeles, from NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures, for those of you not in the business. This interview is with Matthew Guilbeault. Matthew is with Novartis, and he is just a wonderful guy. I met Matthew when he worked at in a different industry, worked in the insurance industry, and a colleague of mine and I quickly assessed that Matthew was very smart, very detail-oriented, had very good at diving into policy and understanding policy, and just a great guy. So one morning out in L.A., Matthew and I ducked into a meeting room or a conference room that wasn't being used. We hijacked it. We had to turn on the air conditioning because the air conditioning was not on. And sat down and had a chat. And I think you're really going to enjoy this. I'm always surprised at how much you learn in these interviews or about the individuals. I learned something about Matthew that I did not know, even though I've known him for a few years. He talks about how he got into the business. And another person who, you know, had the skills but transferred from one industry to another. He used to be in insurance, and now he's in pharmaceuticals, which is related, but very different. So here it is, and I hope you enjoy the interview. We are sure. Here in LA for NCSL.
Yes.
And it's a gathering of legislators from 50 states and policymakers. Mm-hmm. Companies are here represented. We're in beautiful, sunny LA,
yep.
Which is wonderful. So why don't we just start kind of back up?
Sure.
What I'd like to do is kind of ask, what was your first political or government job? Why don't we
wow.
start there?
That takes me way back.
Yeah, because you're not 22 anymore.
No, so I'm not 22.
Right.
Yeah, your listeners can't see that. So, it takes me all the way back to the 1990s, to be honest with you. I'm dating myself here. But, I attended a small private college in upstate New York, College of St. Rose.
Okay.
And my major was history and political science with a pre-law concentration. I anticipated going to law school, but it took me a while to actually get to law school. We'll get to that later. And during that time in undergrad, I was a commuter, so I didn't live on campus. It was a small campus, and I worked my way through college. And I worked my way through college like a lot of people still do today, and that is waiting tables, right? I was a waiter.
So you paid your own tuition?
Yeah, I paid my own tuition.
And exactly. What was the tuition? Do you remember?
I don't remember, and it's probably increased tenfold since then.
I'm sure.
You know?
Okay.
But it's work, right? It's work. It's a stretch, but it's an investment, and it's a wise investment.
Yep.
And obviously, you know, coming from where I am now, having the advantage of hindsight, you know, investment in your education and your career is always a good idea,
yeah.
especially when you're young, just yep. thinking about that.
So you commuted
stuff.
All 4 years?
Yeah, so I commuted all 4 years. Well, actually, I transferred in there 2 years, after 2 years. I had kind of an unusual course out of high school into college. My first year of college, I actually traveled to Prescott, Arizona, and I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University to be a pilot. So I thought I was going to be a pilot, and I spent a year out there to be a pilot, training to be a pilot, and then after the year found out that, you know what, maybe a pilot is not what I want to be at the end of the day.
How did you discover that?
It was interesting because my father, when I was younger, was in a flight club at the local airport, and that makes us sound like we were affluent, but we were anything but. My parents were very blue-collar. My mom was a nurse, and my dad was blue-collar, and you know, I was the first one in my family to go to college, but you know, this was his hobby, and he part owned an airplane out of a flying club, like him and, I don't know, 12 other people or something like that. And I remember going out there as a kid. He'd bring me out there as a kid, and he'd be working on the plane or doing whatever you could on the plane. And then the flight instructor was there, and the flight instructor said, "Hey, do you want to go up? Do you want to fly?" And I said, "Yeah, this is fantastic. I'm like, let's go fly." I don't know how old I am, right? I'm an early teenager. Let's say I'm 13 maybe or something like that. And I'm flying out of Albany International Airport where they land like Delta 747s, right? And I'm in this little tiny two-seater plane, right? And we're taking off and we taxi out. The instructor was an interesting guy. He wasn't very communicative. So he was like, okay, do this, do this, do this.
And you're flying the plane.
And I'm flying the plane. I'm sitting in the left seat. First time in the plane. Don't know what any of the controls are. It probably was. I mean, no physical, no checks, no nothing, right? I'm just in the plane. And I have no idea what anything does in this plane, right? I'm sitting there. I mean, I can't even drive a car yet. This is how young I am. So we go, and the takeoff of the plane is incredibly easy. Airplanes, I don't know if you know this, but airplanes essentially take themselves off. Okay. Like, they want to fly.
Okay.
You get them up to speed, and they just take off, and they just go.
Okay.
So then we get up there, and it's a complex situation where you're using your feet to steer the back of the plane, the rudder in the back of the plane, and then you're using your hands on the wheel to steer what they call the elevators, which makes the plane pitch and yaw.
Okay.
But when you make a turn, it's a combination of the two. It's not like a car where you just turn the wheel and then you go around the turn. You actually like turn the wheel plus you have to kick the back end out with your feet as well. So it's kind of like almost standing on a ball.
Not easy.
No, not easy.
Particularly your first time.
Exactly.
At 13.
At 13, exactly. Yeah. It is a little tiny plane. So then we come around and we're flying around a little bit, and it's a lot of fun, right? But I'm very nervous, obviously. You know, I got a death grip on the yoke. And we come around to land the thing, right? And he's like, okay, land the plane. I mean, literally, that's what he says to me. Land the plane. And I said, I'm 13, so I'm not using the expletives that I would use today. But I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I'm like, land the plane. I don't know. I don't even know how to fly the plane, but just land the plane. So we're coming around for the approach. And I said, I'm not landing the plane. And he's like, land the plane. And I'm like, I'm not landing the plane. And you're like, you're landing the plane. So he's all disgruntled, right? He's like angry at me that I'm not landing the plane. So then we land the plane and we touch down, and the plane lands at like 100 miles an hour, right? Like literally 100 miles an hour we're coming in. And we touch down on the ground, and I failed to tell you, but I'm scared of heights, right? So I'm scared of heights this entire time. I'm really nervous. I'm flying this plane. We come down for a landing, we touch down, and then we're just whizzing down the runway at like 100 miles an hour. And then we go by the place where we're supposed to stop. You know, the little turnoff place. We go whizzing by it at 100 miles an hour. And he turns to me, he yells at me, he's like, hit the brakes. And I know, this is crazy, right? This is crazy. So my reaction is, where are the brakes? Yeah. I don't know where the brakes are. You know? And he starts screaming, use your toes, use your toes. So it turns out, right, the pedals that I'm using in flight to steer the back of the airplane, if I pitch up and use the toes of my feet, that's where the brakes are.
But how would you know that?
I had no clue. No clue.
Who was this person?
Yeah. I'm not naming names. I don't know if he's still with us.
He was a flight instructor?
He was a flight instructor. He very obviously and apparently didn't enjoy his job. You know,
a little hands off, I would say.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, but it was a lot of fun.
So that was your first experience.
That was my first experience. And then you're thinking, right, well, how do I get from there to actually would you ever want to step in an airplane again? I thought it was pretty neat. And I was young. I didn't have a lot of guidance because my parents didn't go to college. So this was my first time doing it. I remember filling out the applications and doing all this kind of stuff in my own, up in my room. I was very independent on this stuff. So I had to make my own decision. It's a funny story, but I reflect all the way back to like the third grade. And in third grade at the time, when I was in third grade, I don't know if you had the same experience, but they had what they call an aptitude test. And you would fill out these seemingly innocuous questions, like 100 questions or something you would do in third grade. And then they would come out and it would kick you out, you know, like if your fortune would be told. And like it would be, well, you would be good at this, right? And they gave you like three choices or something. And I remember one of them was an airplane pilot.
Okay.
So then you were required in the third grade. Third grade seems a little early for this. But you were required then to do like a project, like a research project on that profession.
Okay.
So I did. On pilots, on what it means to be a pilot, how much pilots are paid, what do they do, blah, 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 kind of things like that. So that stuck in my mind, and I'm thinking, well, I flew the plane and I landed it. I found the brakes, right? And my aptitude said I said I should be a pilot. So I said, okay, let's apply to flight school. And off I went. Yeah, it did. It did. On a paper level, it made sense.
So you applied and went.
And got accepted and went and lived in Arizona, and it was fantastic. And we flew planes around Arizona and had a great time.
Okay.
And then I quickly came to the realization, if you're going to be a pilot, you're one of two tracks. The first track is going into the military. Because at the end of the day, to be a pilot, you need hours in the seat.
And is that the most common track?
That's the most common track.
Because it's expensive to do it on your own.
It's extremely expensive to do it on your own.
Right.
And if you don't go the airline, or the, I'm sorry, the military route, you can't just go to an airline. So what you're doing is you're scrambling for hours, and you're trying to find hours. And now it's all reflecting back on me about why this guy is so angry, why this flight instructor is so angry at me and everybody, because he's not getting paid very much money. He's not enjoying his job. He's just looking for hours because he wants to get out of this little tiny podunk plane in Albany, New York, and get into something that he can actually fly.
I think you're being a little generous to this flight instructor.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even tell you how to land the plane, where the brakes were.
Yeah.
I mean, even if he was unhappy in his job, he could have maybe mentioned a few of these things.
I agree.
But you're very very kind in your... So you have to decide which track to go or not
go. Correct.
And what would you decide?
Yeah, well, I tried the military track at first. I went and you're heavily recruited when you're in college and you demonstrate even the slightest bit of interest in the military. Recruiters really pick up on that stuff. And the next thing you know, I don't know if you have any experience in this, but the next thing you know, they're calling you and they're driving to your house and they're picking you up in their car and they're bringing you to different places and you're taking these tests.
Have you finished school?
Oh, no. I'm still in college at the time.
Oh, so this is post, but prior, so you come to the end of flight school.
No, I didn't actually finish flight school. I went to college instead.
So you never went to flight school?
No, I went to aeronautical college.
Okay.
So I went for an aeronautical degree to be a pilot, as opposed to just the traditional, I'm going to take next number of hours to be a private pilot.
Got it.
This really sets you up to be a commercial
pilot.
And
the minute you started down this road, they started reaching out to you.
Exactly. Yep. So I went through the whole process, and, this is back in the 90s, right? So the big movie is Top Gun, right? And I'm young, and I'm thinking all these grandiose thoughts about how cool this would be, right? And this is going to be quite a track to get me to where I am now in Los Angeles, right? But then I go through the whole process, and they started this new program. It was a 2-year program. Typically, you need a 4-year degree to be a Navy pilot, to even start flight training. But they started this new one, and it was for exceptionally gifted people. Which turns out I'm not. So I thought I was at the time, but apparently I'm not, according to the Navy. So I went through and went through this whole application process and did well on the aptitude test, but then ultimately didn't get in.
Okay.
So I was crushed. I really was pinning a lot of hope on this. And then the interesting part is then when the Navy gets done with you, then the Army steps in. And now the Army's calling me, and they're saying, well, you can't fly fighter jets off a carrier, because that's what I was, trying to do. I mean, what a great job that would be, right? Thankfully, I didn't do that, though, because my life would be markedly different than it is now, and I'm happy in my life. But then the Army starts calling, and they're saying, well, you can't fly Navy jets off a carrier. Do you want to fly attack helicopters? Which seems at this point to be very attractive, right? But at the point that I want to fly Navy jets off of carriers, I was like, nah, I don't really want to fly helicopters. So I said, you know what? And I'm not going on track B because I've already experienced what that does to you as a person and a flight instructor, right?
Right.
And I said, you know what? Maybe flight will be a hobby, and I need to turn this thing around and get serious about what I want to do.
So do you still have the hobby today?
I still have my flight case, I have my headset, I still have all my books, I have my flight log, but I haven't flown an airplane in a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you still afraid of heights?
No, actually I'm not, which is interesting.
How'd you get over that?
I don't know how I got over that. Huh. I think it's just one of these things you just kind of grow out of after a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, flying probably helped, overcoming it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I enjoy flying today. I like being on a big airplane.
You do?
Yeah.
So you're working your way through college?
Yep.
Come out of college?
Yep. Yeah, I went to a community college, came back to Albany, went to a community college, and then transferred into College St. Rose in upstate New York, New York, for history and political science with a law degree. And that in and of itself is an interesting story because it's a private Catholic college, and at the time that I went, it was very Catholic. In fact, they had nuns in full nun garb, habits, I think they're called.
Yes.
And I had no experience with this whatsoever. So I walk into the situation where the nuns are teaching the class, and all I've heard about nuns is, something to do with rulers and your knuckles.
Right.
So
kneeling on rice.
Exactly. But in very short order, I found them to be lovely people and a tremendous experience. And I really enjoyed the small college. I had a choice of going to a big college or a small college. I really enjoyed the small college because they all knew you by name, and you knew your professors by name. So there's some accountability there. I wasn't one of 1,000. I was one of 30, right? So if I'm walking through the commons and, you know, my professor says, "Where were you in my class this morning?" I have some accountability. You know, I have to answer to that. And at that point in my life, it was a good thing for me. So okay. I very much enjoyed it.
So what did you do when you graduated?
So I graduated, and as I was saying, I was working my way through college undergrad as a waiter in a restaurant. So we got all the legislators were in there, all the lobbyists were in there all the time. So I got to know them on a first-name basis from just, you know, waiting tables with them. And, you know, had the opportunity to slip in, "Hey, I happen to be graduating from College of St. Rose with a history and political science degree, and, you know, can you help me out?" And made some connections there.
That's great.
Yeah, isn't it? It's very fortuitous in that regard. But the lesson is you can't be shy about it, right? I mean, right. You got to go out there. You got to promote yourself. You got to look for opportunities. The worst you're going to get is a no.
And is that how you got your first job?
Yeah, and that's how I got my first job.
And what was that?
And I was a staffer for a first-term senator in New York.
Okay.
Moving out of the state assembly, needed a new staff, moving into the Senate, the upper house. And started me on that track. And it was interesting because, I got a card and I was told, "Show up Monday morning at 10 a.m. And that's exactly what I did. And I showed up, and I met the rest of the staff. And then I spent 7 years working in the state legislature.
Okay.
Eventually moving up to the legislative director and the committee director position, where I would handle legislation. It was interesting because everybody came in on the same plane.
Legislative director for that senator or for the caucus?
For that senator and for the committee. And at the time, we had the elections committee, and then eventually we moved on to the crime and corrections committee. So I got to meet with lobbyists. I got to learn how the bills moved.
Yep.
I got to learn how the internal structure of the legislature worked.
Yep.
I still think very, very strongly, and this is not to denigrate anybody else's career path, but if you want to be a lobbyist and you want to be in government affairs, the best thing you can do is figure out is to work in-house for a while. You make tremendous connections. People stick around for a long time. And you really learn how to process.
And you learn the process. The process is critical.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree 100%.
Okay.
So, yeah. So spent a number of years there and had a lot of fun. Learned a lot.
Spent 7 years there.
And these are the days where New York State Legislature would go around the clock. So we would come in at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning. And during budget time, which is halfway through the session, and at the end of the session, we have these extended sessions where literally you would work from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock the next morning.
Wow.
You would be in there, and you would be expected at 4 o'clock in the morning, they'd be having these caucus meetings or they'd be moving legislation because they're trying to hash out the budget or whatever it is.
Yes.
And then we're expected to be cognizant enough to, like, do work at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had, you know, it was what an experience. It was fantastic. I would never want to do it again. But looking back on it, it was a lot of fun.
A young person's gig.
Yeah, totally.
So what'd you do when you left there?
So then, you know, you make connections with lobbyists when you're there because that's what you're doing. You're on the other side of the issue. You're learning issues.
Yeah.
You have a dozen appointments every single day, and they're coming in from every subject, right? You know, at one point you're meeting with crime and corrections people or law enforcement. The next point you're meeting with trial attorneys. The next point you're meeting with environmental people. And what I quickly learned was a lot, and I take this into my lobbying now, into my government affairs practice right now. People walk in and they have the assumption that you know what they're talking about. And as a staffer, a young staffer, you really have no clue.
So you're being educated.
I'm being educated, but I'm priming the conversations because what I've adopted and I picked up from some of the more experienced staffers was the little tidbit that when they first walk in the door and they start speaking, right, you can immediately judge where they are on the scale, right? If they immediately run in and start using acronyms, you would say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa," you know. And I would literally say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." I said, "Explain this to me like I'm a 3-year-old, like I know nothing about this." And most of the time I didn't know anything about it, right? But it was my job to learn about it because then I had to digest it and then explain it to the senator and give him some advice in terms of what I wanted him to do.
Okay.
But I take that today and I still do the same thing. And I say, "Listen, I'm going to start by explaining to you like you've never heard of any of this stuff. And if it's insulting, just let me know and I'll speed it up. But I don't want to talk over your head. Because if you don't do that, you can waste that hour, you know, or that 15 minutes or whatever time you have."
Right.
So made tremendous connections. And then an opportunity presented itself in the private sector. And I started working for the Medical Society of the State of New York representing physicians.
Okay.
And now I'm the lobbyist. And now I'm on the other end of the couch, right? And I'm walking in and I'm creating these relationships with staffers who I once was.
Right.
And
how was the transition? Was it easy or difficult?
It was fantastic. I loved it.
Okay.
Yeah. It was great. Time commitment didn't actually go down because now you're attending the fundraisers, right?
Right.
And as a staffer, you didn't really attend too many fundraisers. You're more interested in the process of the legislation. So.
And you have to be there all night standing outside as their legislature's meeting.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And how many years did you spend at the medical school?
I think I did about 5 years, maybe a little bit over 5 years with the Medical Society.
And then where did you go after that?
And then, interestingly, they were reducing their lobbying force. So they said that particular division was being not cut completely, but mm-hmm. but reduced. So then I went over and I worked for the National Federation of Independent Businesses.
Okay.
Because small business was, is something that I really truly believe in. Small business is tough, and people are trying to make ends meet.
Yep.
And if you can help them, it gives me a tremendous sense of satisfaction. Yep. And if I really truly believe in what I'm doing as an advocate, I feel like I do a lot better job. I think that, and that goes for anybody, right?
Right.
So I really believe in mom and pop shops and small businesses in the United States and growth and creation and supporting the economy and just kind of helping them do their job. It makes me feel really good about that. So I really enjoyed that.
And then how many years were you there?
I was probably there for another 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
This is becoming this jump through this 5 year period and kind of finding my spot.
And then from there, you went on to the insurance?
No, from there, interestingly, I became a contract lobbyist. And some opportunities presented itself to go out on my own. And some clients came to me and said, hey, would you be interested in representing me? And it didn't mesh with obviously still being an employed lobbyist.
Right.
So I did the contract lobbyist thing for a while.
Okay.
And I represented some great clients. I represented the American College of Surgeons, pulling off of my medical experience.
Yep.
I represented the Motorcycle Industry Council, which is the manufacturers of all the different motorcycles, the trade associations. And as a kid, I've always been into motorcycles, so I loved it. It was a fantastic client.
Do you own a motorcycle?
Yeah. Oh, I own 7 motorcycles.
7?
I think. I lose track of how many motorcycles I have, literally. Yes.
Wow.
I really like motorcycles.
What's your favorite motorcycle?
I have a Kawasaki ZRX 1100. And it's just a great all-around bike. It does everything you want to do. It doesn't go on the racetrack, and I do race motorcycles as well. I spent a couple of years of my life racing professionally, road racing motorcycles, like in Daytona and Virginia and things like that. But that's a story for another day. But the ZRX is beautiful. You can fit 2 people up on it. It's got a big torquey motor. You can take it long distances. It's just a lot of fun. Yeah.
So how long did you race for? How many years?
I raced probably for 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how often would you race in a given year?
Let me see. We raced maybe in the season that we raced. My home track was Loudoun, New Hampshire.
Okay.
So we would trailer them up from Albany, New York into Loudoun, New Hampshire, and we would road race motorcycles. And
you say we. Who's we?
We had a whole group. When
you
get up there and you're doing this kind of stuff, you meet people very quickly.
Yep.
And interesting, you make lifelong friends, and still people that I learned, met on the racetrack are still some of my closest friends. And maybe we did it 9 times out of the season or something. The season was, from the time the snow melted to the time the snow came again. So
now, and what is the average or top speed in a typical race?
Yeah, well, it depends on the track. Yeah, on that track, front straightaway, depending on what kind of bike you're riding. I mean, they have different size bikes. You can ride little bikes or big bikes or very big bikes. The big bikes are maybe doing 150 down the straightaway. It's kind of a short straightaway.
Okay.
The little bikes are just doing over 100. The track that I ride on now, I ride a little bike, and I can just get it over 100 miles an hour down the straight.
Wow.
Yeah, which is not really that fast, to be honest with you. It sounds fast, but if you're riding, like, one of these big bikes, they have 1,000cc super bikes that will do, which I've raced on Daytona. You're up on the high banks of Daytona, and these bikes are doing 200 miles an hour. And I'm on a little bike that's doing 150 miles an hour. And you've never experienced anything like this in your life. So you're going along on this high bank, and you're like literally like riding on a wall. And you're doing 150 miles an hour because that's as fast as the bike will go. You're going as fast as the bike will go. And it was my first time out there. I have no idea what I'm doing out there, right? So I'm up on these high banks. It's crazy. And you're watching. It doesn't have a speedometer, but it has an RPM, right? It has a tachometer, and you're watching your tachometer, and it's just steady. You're full throttle as fast as the thing will go. And then all of a sudden, your tachometer starts increasing, and your speed starts increasing. You're wondering, well, why am I going faster? All of a sudden, I'm on the high banks. Why am I going faster? And soon you find out why you're going faster. And the reason you're going faster is because there's one of these big 1,000cc super bikes that's coming up behind you. You're doing 150. They're doing 200 miles an hour. And they're coming up behind you at such a rate that they're literally pushing air, which before they get to you, speeds you up as you catch that cushion of air, speeds you up. And then they go by you at 50 miles an hour faster than you're going at like a foot away. Yeah, the words that came out of my mouth was not exactly incredible when this experience happened to me, but it was very similar to that.
For someone who earlier you said that you were at one point afraid of heights.
Yeah.
And here you are on a bike doing over 150 miles an hour.
Yeah, you never experienced anything like it in your
life. It would seem the fear would be,
It was. It was a transition in my life, to be honest with you. And it was something
You wanted to overcome?
Yeah. Fear has always been something that I've wanted to overcome, to be honest with you. You know?
Well, I think you've accomplished
it. I did. Yeah. And then you turn into a thrill seeker, right? And then you learn to embrace that feeling and to use that energy that it gives you. And then you seek it out, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that how you seek it out today?
And that's how I seek it out today. I get on the racetrack today. We don't race. Yeah, and lobbying.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
There's nothing more exciting than and thrilling and nerve-wracking than that.
So are you, I'm sorry, are you still racing? I know you're still riding. You're still racing today?
We do track days, what we call track days. So they're not official races.
But
you trailer it out and you pay the money and you run around the track and, you know, drag your knee for a couple hours. It's a lot of fun.
What can you tell for people who, what can you tell us about racing motorcycles that we wouldn't, I mean, you obviously just told us one thing. Is there anything else you could tell us that we wouldn't know or understand or appreciate?
Yeah, the interesting thing is racing motorcycles, the analogy that I use, and it's something that nobody would ever come to unless they do it, but I use this analogy with people that do it, and they all universally agree, is like solving a math problem that there's no end to. It's like solving an internal math problem. And you're sitting here wondering, how could this possibly be a math problem? Well, when you're on a racetrack, you're timed around the track, and you're timed in hundredths and thousandths of a second.
Okay.
So your objective in doing this, number one, is to get around safely and then become and then increase your level of competence in terms of your ability to do that. But there is an optimal way around this racetrack, an optimal line around this racetrack that will give you the best time.
Okay.
And that's what you're always searching for. So, and it's not always
that's
intuitive.
What you're always searching for.
Yeah, exactly.
What I would be searching for is making it around the track.
Yes, yes.
Once.
Yes, exactly.
And then
You start that way. Yeah.
And so you're trying to find that perfect route around the track.
Exactly.
To hit that optimal speed.
Exactly. And the track is not an oval. It's like a 12 to 18 turn track.
Okay.
So every turn is a math problem, right? So you have your input, you have your braking point, you have your apex point, and you have your exit point in that track on that particular turn. And you have 18 of those around the track. So you're constantly...
18?
18 of those. So you're constantly manipulating these turns. And you're saying, well, what happens if I try this? Or I move here, or I do this. So you're adjusting everything as you move around. And then finally you come across the finish line, and then you look at your timer and you say, okay, well, that reduced my time by a hundredth of a second. So that's great. And this is, you're literally dealing in hundredths of a second.
And so then you can adjust your next time.
And then you go into the next turn.
And you never solve the Rubik's Cube.
You'll never solve it, exactly. Yeah. You will just continually work to get faster and faster and faster. And it's fantastic. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Is there any other way that you, what do you, skydive or anything else you do for thrill seeking?
No,
That's enough.
Yeah, that's it. That's all for me.
Well, now, so you did some contract lobbying, and then I know you ended up eventually at the Professional Insurance Agents Association.
Yep.
How would you compare for our listeners contract lobbying to working for, say, an association?
You know, stability is the biggest thing, to be honest with you.
Yes.
I mean, you know, contract lobbying, at least in New York, is one of two tracks. And, you know, you could go out on your own and hang a flag, or find a partnership or do something small, or you can go with a firm. You can go with a law firm or with an established lobbying firm. Most of them are law firms in New York. The stability of the law firm in New York, it increases your stability in that you have the resources. Obviously, you're not the only person out there. If you can't make a meeting, you get somebody else to go to the meeting. Clients come in the door, although to a large extent, you have to find your own clients. But taking the other track with doing it on your own or like hanging shingle like I did, you know, an opportunity presents itself where a client comes to you and you say, I could write a contract for this particular client that would sustain me, right? I'm not going to get rich doing this, but it would give me an opportunity that I could give it a shot. And now I'm out there and I'm looking for other clients. It's hard because a lot of the other clients are already retained, right? They've already contracted with their lobbyists.
Right.
And there's a code among lobbyists in New York that you're not poaching, right? So you have to look for these opportunities. And if you're a little guy in this world in Albany and you're competing against these very large and established firms, you tend to get a lot of scraps. Or maybe you tend to get a little scraps. You don't tend to get a lot. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah. And really it's only there. So what you're saying is there's not a lot of change from an entity changing from one lobbying firm to the next. So really everyone's looking for the new entities or companies or whatever coming in.
Yeah.
And for a new guy like you hanging out a shingle.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking at you and they're looking at established firms.
Exactly.
And it's hard to get selected.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're beating the bushes out there. And to be honest with you, some of the opportunities you're getting, you don't want. Like, you know, I had an opportunity to represent Puppy Mills. And you know what? I declined it. And I said, I'm not going to be the Puppy Mill lobbyist. You know what I mean? It goes back to you have to believe in what you're doing.
So let's jump ahead to your current responsibilities and your current job. What brings you to NCSL?
Yeah, a little over 3 months ago, I accepted a position as Associate Director of State Government Affairs for Novartis Pharmaceuticals, which, you know, you think is a completely different direction coming from insurance, but it's not really because everything's insurance. When I lobbied for the State Medical Society, I was thinking I was going to work on healthcare issues, but you're not. Doctors are mostly concerned about insurance. And then I went into property and casualty insurance and worked 10 years for professional insurance agents. And now I'm working for pharmaceuticals, and pharmaceuticals is insurance as well, because somebody's got to pay for it, right? At the end of the day, somebody's got to pay for it, whether you're a practitioner, whether you're, you know, a policyholder, or whether you are a manufacturer. At the end of the day, insurance pays for it, and you're paying for it either through private sector insurance or you're paying through it through Medicaid or Medicare. So a lot of my efforts now are still working on reimbursement, patient access to pharmaceuticals and things of that nature.
And what are the big issues that the industry is facing today?
Yeah, the big issue is access, to be honest with you. And you read a lot about it in the newspaper, and you hear a lot about it on the news right now. And obviously the president is talking about it, and HHS is talking about it. And what they talk about is high drug prices, right? And it's easy to come to the conclusion of, well, drug prices are too high. That's a statement that's easy to make. It doesn't require a lot of thought or preparation to make that statement, because you look at some of the prices for some of the treatments. But what you're doing in that is you're ignoring the underlying factors as to why the drug prices are high in the first place. And ironically, what you're ignoring is the process that the government requires you to go through as a manufacturer to get that drug approved, and how expensive that process is, that necessitates you being able to recoup some of those costs.
Right.
So it's an education thing.
So back to where you began your career, being educated and then educating others. Now, what are there certain parts of the country or states that you cover?
Yeah, my states now, when I was with the professional insurance agents, I had 5 states. I had New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont. And now I'm just in 3. So I'm in New York, Maine, and Vermont.
Okay.
You know, pharmaceuticals is different than insurance. And I'm no longer representing small businesses anymore.
Yep.
I'm corporate now. So it's
and do,
it's
do
a
you
new
work?
World.
Oh, sorry. Do you work out of your house or an office?
No, I actually work out of my house. It's
okay.
We're all remote. And, you know, you're assigned your territory in your states. And that's not to say that we don't work in concert with and coordination with our colleagues in other states. We have regular conference calls. I have a number of colleagues that are here in Los Angeles with me today.
Yes.
We compare best practices and things of that nature. But the nice thing is, you know, it's kind of like the racetrack, right? You're kind of out there figuring it out yourself. You know, you're out there and you're trying new things, and you know, you're queuing off other people and what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, Matt, that's great.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to wrap it up. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the time.
And we appreciate it, and I hope it goes well out here in L.A.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
All right, great.
Always great seeing you.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, I had no idea that Matthew raced motorcycles. It's just incredible. There is not a chance that I would or could be able to do that. Many of you felt the same way. And for those of you who don't know Matthew, if you've met him, you wouldn't suspect that was necessarily his hobby. But what a great guy and a great interview. I hope you enjoyed it. And so until next Monday, this is Lobbying Show signing off.